Welcome to the 45th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast with all the subtlety of a Chris Gayle 100.
So on the menu for you this episode, Andy's going to be telling us about Nasser Hussein's most ignominious moment. I'm going to be telling you a little story about his brother, in fact, who I had the pleasure of meeting a couple of weeks ago. We're going to be reviewing The Night Watchman, which is Wisden's new quarterly. We've got an interview with Nishant Joshi of Alternative Cricket, and we're going to be asking about the role of captains in the 21st century. So what's been getting you excited recently?
Well, there was quite an emotional county championship game at the Oval last week. Sussex came to play Surrey, and two Surrey old boys in the Sussex side. Chris Jordan was one of them. He's one of those players really seen as something of a prodigy. Really fast bowler, hard-hitting batsman. Never really kicked off at Surrey.
We all got very excited back in the day, didn't we? And thought he was about to sort of break onto
Well, I think it's a great example of how excited everyone was that the debate started, ooh, will he play for England? Will he play for the West Indies? And very soon his performance
meant that wasn't
quite, exactly. And it was great to see him go back to the Oval, bowl with real ferocity on a wicket with very little in it, take a five for in the first innings. And it's great to see a young talent starting to emerge, starting to make the most of it.
But talking of young talents, it was kind of quite a poignant match as well, wasn't it?
Well, the other returnee was Rory Hamilton-Brown, who, I mean, his return was a far more emotional event. Surrey obviously had gambled on Hamilton-Brown, given him the captaincy at a very young age, and he'd obviously suffered a real tragedy last year in the death of Tom Maynard that we've discussed quite a bit on this podcast, actually. And for him to come back, by all accounts, he was given a fairly warm reception at the Oval. And I think, as importantly, it's just great to see him playing and enjoying his game again. He didn't make a massive contribution to the game, like a well-compiled 39 in the first innings. But I think what matters more than anything is to see him back playing, back enjoying his game. And again, another talent who we hope will go on to achieve perhaps what he deserves and what he merits.
It's interesting what you're saying, because I think one of the things that's really caught my, or sort of, I'm reminded of it at the beginning of every single county season, is that everyone, you know, the beginning of county seasons, usually the papers run these stories of, you know, one man and a dog at the Oval, and that's it. And this is cricket dying. But what's been really nice, about the county season at the moment has been that there has been all these little sort of sub stories that have gone on within everything.
So many great players involved right
now.
So
many great players
of the season,
and even so, all the internationals are playing, but you also have all the potential internationals. So in Derbyshire versus Yorkshire at the moment, Joe Root making a double hundred, and obviously
not the only double centurion.
Chesney Hughes has done pretty well for himself. Pretty impressive. Have you seen any of it? I haven't seen any of it.
No, I need to go and catch the highlights of it. I think the Chesney Hughes stories is fantastic though, just because he's seen as a player of real potential who again has kind of fired in, you know, bursts without anything. And they've moved into opener. He's gone and made double hundred. And Derbyshire's, you know, it's unfashionable county in the first division.
Well, unfashionable, but they've also got other attractions this season.
Well, they've got the one and only Shiv Chanderpaul. They're definitely high on our hit list to go and watch.
So while that's been a bit of a run fest going on up north, down in the Essex-Hampshire match, which was very low scoring and an absolutely sort of early season, typical early season green top thriller. Up north you've got the likes of Chesney Hughes, the likes of Joe Root, Bairstow made a century as well. You've got all these potential players all wanting to impress early on in the season, but Alistair Cook was back playing for Essex for the first time in I don't know how long.
I think, just to take you back to your point, I entirely agree, this lazy journalism of, oh look, one man and his dog at Lord's or whatever. I mean, the simple fact is, most of us have jobs and are not able to be at the County Championship every day. But I think there's so many cricket fans who are there following this, utterly compelled. I mean, there's some fantastic cricket going on. And I remember last episode I was talking about, God, I'm getting quite into the IPL. You know, the County Cricket Championship has walked all over that, frankly, since it's been going.
Even despite the fact that, as your very very wonderful opening line made reference to, Chris Gayle has done wonderful
things. I'd rather watch Chesney Hughes. Simple as. So away from all the good things, what has been getting you down?
A couple of weeks ago, I play for a little local club in Cambridge where I live. And we were on tour in Essex. We don't go terribly adventurous.
Glamour.
And we turned up for the first game. I turned up a day late, and the rest of the team were, I think it's fair to say, rather the worse for wear after the first night on tour. And anyway, it turned out that someone who I sort of thought I vaguely recognised, it turned out, the whisper ran around the team, that in fact this was Mel Hussein. who is NASA's brother, who is a banker of some description. And yes, I did say a banker rather than anything else, although the story might tell something different. Sorry to be for family friendly racing that we need to anyway. It was just interesting because I've genuinely never come across a more I've choose my language carefully here.
Should we go with unpleasant?
A more unpleasant person on a cricket pitch.
Because you kind of expect village cricket, there's kind of all the types of cricket. If you go away from sort of, you know, first 11 club cricket, which can be a bit in your face, I mean, village cricket's a real true Sunday cricket. That should be that bit more gentle,
particularly
surely.
Because this was the first match for both of us of the entire season. But anyway, he stood at first slip looking very grumpy, and then when he went out to bat, I had a little chat with him. He was opening the batting for the opposing team, and he said he just came out to me and said, what end is the bowler gonna start from? And I said, I have absolutely no idea. I'm not opening the bowling. Our captain's over there. Go and ask him. And he just looked at me and described me and the whole team as inept. And then went in, and anyway, he made. I mean, he's a decent batsman. He made 40 odd, and then loudly disputed a decision when he was given out off a very loud edge, but not before he berated the... I mean, there must have been a 16-year-old or something batting with him, and not before he berated the 16-year-old for trying to take singles when Hussain was on strike, and then had gone for some ludicrous runs when the other chap was on strike. And it was... I don't know. It was just interesting, because I was thinking of inviting him to come onto the podcast, and then I thought...
You could have asked him on to justify his actions. No. I think it's interesting, because obviously, being the younger brother of a great England captain, and then, you know, trying to carve out your own niche in cricket, it can't be easy. I suppose what you really need to do is just accept that you're playing it for fun, which it sounds like he hasn't done.
But if you are out there listening, Mel, then
We're friendly
chaps. So anyway, away from the English county scene and the club scene,
I've been thinking all things Harare, where the basement battle of the Test arena has been going on, Zimbabwe versus Bangladesh. And I follow Zimbabwean cricket with particular interest. Like, I always look out for them. And it's been quite an engaging series, actually, sort of back and forth. But in one particular area, it has been completely dismal. And I've never followed, I think I can genuinely say this, I've never followed a Test series where wickets have been thrown away quite so wantonly. And I think you often watch a batting performance and you try and separate those wickets that were kind of earned by the bowling team and they're kind of given. And I mean, both teams were guilty, but there was a point particularly in the first Test where Bangladesh just... every wicket was a ludicrous shot to very good ball. And it does rather kill things as a spectacle, actually.
Well, it sort of kills things as a spectacle, but I was sort of watching, in inverted commas, quite a lot of it on Crick Info. And it was quite engaging, the fact that you go on it and, you know, a team would be 120 for 2. And then you go off to a meeting or something, you come back and they'd be 180 for 8, having all gone out to what looked like absolutely... I mean, it kept it interesting, in a way.
I think what it suggests, unsurprisingly, is that in terms of mental maturity, you know, these are two batting lineups with a long way to go.
When you win the toss, bat. If you're in doubt, think about it, then bat. If you have very big doubts, consult a colleague, then bat. That's what W.G. Grace had to say on the matter. And Andy's going to tell us about a time when Nasser Hussain did otherwise.
It's November the 5th, 2002, the first day of the Ashes, and it's a scorcher at Brisbane. England are, as they often were at that time, the huge underdogs in the Ashes. The build-up to the series has been a mess. Darren Goff's out with injury. Graham Thorpe has pulled out with personal problems. You know, key bowler, key batsman gone. But there's actually still a bit of optimism in this England camp. Hussain and Fletcher have actually got England tough, you know, made them tough to beat. They're no longer the pushover they were throughout the mid-90s. And there's a sense that maybe, just maybe, they can make this a contest. I think it's fair to say by the end of day one, all optimism was gone. Nasser Hussain wins the toss and puts Australia in. In Wisden words, it will go down as one of the costliest decisions in Test history. By the end of the day, Australia were 364 for 2, and England attempted some sort of a fight back. They actually batted quite well on the second day, but they go on to lose the Test by crushing 380 runs. So I guess the question is why? Why did Hussain choose to bowl? And the interesting thing about this, looking back, is that I've read lots and lots of different articles and reports on this and interviews with Nasser Hussain, and Nasser Hussain's answer isn't constant. It changes somewhat, which suggests to me a little bit that I guess as time goes on and he gets constantly harassed over this mistake, his own memory of events changes slightly. So we have to maybe bear that in mind.
But I suspect as well at the same time that there might be, you know, the fact that he didn't have a clear reason why he was deciding to bat might have that. You know, he had a little thought about the weakness of their batting, a little thought about the strength of the Australian bowling, a little thought about the conditions. And often, this is what comes into play with a lot of tosses, that there are so many small little factors that you have to weigh up. And ultimately, they don't actually go in one direction or the other very, very heavily, but the result goes very heavily in one direction.
And I think that's a good explanation. I think it was a combination of little things. One interesting thing, he's pointed to Marcus Trisgothick's contribution, which feels a little bit to me like shifting the blame. But Hussein has talked about the fact that Trisgothick had a net that morning, an outdoor net, not, it must be said, on the test track. But Trisgothick said, well, the track I had a net on looks quite a lot like the track in the test match that's going to be used for the test match, and it was doing quite a bit. Why don't we bowl first? Frankly, this seems like an unbelievably flimsy premise on which to build a decision, which kind of leads us into our second reason that's, I think, the most surprising of all, is that in some interviews, Hussein has admitted that he was actually quite distracted that morning. Apparently, rather hilariously, there was an extended debate over which coin to be used for the toss. He was distracted by the media obligations he had in the morning, and he admits in one interview that he actually didn't properly examine the pitch, which is a staggering omission, if that's true, for a player who is notorious for his professionalism. He has, however, in other interviews, talked about the pitch. And I think this is a great example of where you have to be careful about trying to read too much into things, because he saw cloud cover and he felt this would be part of, and he felt there was a bit of moisture on the pitch.
There's going to be a bit of a swing, and he had quite a swing. I mean, Simon Jones
quite
was bowling, Hoggard was bowling, both of whom could swing it.
And I think he obviously saw that and felt there would be something there. But I think the obvious point, especially when you're somewhere like Brisbane rather than Headingley, what happened was not that surprising, in that the sun came out, the cloud went, the pitch dried up. There's a lovely.
Well, I suppose the thing is, but the interesting thing is that often people start to get it wrong later on in the test match. So when you're calling a toss at the beginning, very often you're thinking about the third and fourth innings, and you're thinking, are we going to want to chase any kind of total on a fourth innings pitch, a fifth day pitch, with the situation as it is. But it's very unusual, conditions-wise, even if the sun does come out, to get it that wrong so immediately.
No.
If that is, and it'll be interesting, something interesting to come on and talk about, which is whether it is about the decision that was wrong, or just whether England were just crap.
Yeah. And I mean, Hussein, talking about how he felt as the pitch kind of unfolded, as it were, as the way it played unfolded, by the fifth or sixth over, nothing was happening, and the world was closing in on me. I thought to myself, oh God, Naz, what have you done? But I wonder if the real issue here was not on the pitch, but in the dressing room. And we often think of the fact that captains are often advised to go with their strong suit. You've got a great bowling lineup, bowl first. You've got a great, I mean, certainly in a lot of cricket, that's often seen as a sensible way of doing things. With Vaughan and Trisgothick in the top order, you felt like batting was patently England's strong suit. But it seems evident that Hussein didn't back his batsman.
I can't remember where I heard it, but I have read somewhere an anecdote that says before he went out to make that toss, Hussein walked into his dressing room and looked around and thought to himself, this is not a team that I can send out to bat against the Australians. And actually, you think, I mean, it's the first morning of the Ashes, enormous hype behind it. Obviously, with the benefit of talking 10 years later, we all think about Harmison's first ball to slip.
Yeah,
but actually, in terms of disastrous first mornings, it's probably more disastrous to be five down when batting than it is to be 120 for none when you're bowling.
It's a fascinating question, because I've seen exactly the same thing done in village cricket again and again. If you're the weak team, bowl first, make a game of it. And the idea is that actually, with the other team batting, things can only be so disastrous.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the issue here is that actually, England batted well when they arrived at the crease. Mm. They were in real dire straits in terms of the game as a whole, but they actually fought really hard. And you wonder if Hussein had backed them, maybe they would have responded. What happened instead was they went on the defensive, tried to bowl, and England's bowling attack really suffered, and they suffered a blow in confidence that I don't think they'd ever really recover.
Okay, so there are two questions here, in my mind, certainly. One of which is, did the toss matter at all? Mm. Was it just that England were awful on the first morning? And the second one is that actually, does even if the conditions weren't conducive to bowling, does the fact that Nasser won the toss and put England into bowl then affect the way that England bowl?
Well, I think there's an interesting point that Steve Waugh was very honest after the game and said, had he won the toss, he'd have asked England's bat as well. Mm. I guess what was interesting is that from Steve Waugh, that wouldn't have been seen as a sign of surrender. He had the bowling attack to back it up. I think from his saying, it did come across as surrender, as a sort of giving up and conceding of territory. But Steve Waugh made a much more interesting point after the game, actually, where he said, the significance of the toss is overrated. Whatever you do first, you've got to do it well. And I think this is fits into the bigger question here. Should we be talking about Nasser Hussein's disastrous decision, or should we be talking about England's disastrous performance? Let's remember that Matthew Hayden, who was the destroyer-in-chief on this first day, was dropped on four separate occasions, including on 40. I mean, with that shambolic fielding, you know, however well you're bowling, it's going to be very hard to back it up.
I think what's really important is to put Nasser's decision, like, even calling him Nasser as if we were on first day terms, but now I've met his brother, maybe
you are, yeah.
But Hussein's decision, I think we have to put back into the context of a very negative mindset within the England camp as a whole. And it's one part of the evidence for that, but perhaps not the overriding reason for their awful performance. Mm.
And there's the final explanation, which is just bad luck. I mean, Simon Jones, we'll all remember, suffered that horrific injury that, in a sense, I don't know if his career, for all the highlights of 2005, I don't know if his career ever quite recovered from that anterior cruciate ligament injury he picked up. And the fact he was England's bowler of the morning, he got Justin Lang, he bowled well, and to lose him to injury, you think, well, you can't really blame Hussein for that. And I think it fits into this broader question that maybe is worth another from the archives feature of, really, do we overthink the toss? I mean, at the end of the day, as Steve Waugh says, whatever position you're in, whether you bowl or bat, do it well, and you'll probably find yourself in a relatively good position in the game after that. To the review, and this episode we're looking at The Night Watchman, the new quarterly magazine from Wisden. And to understand kind of the thinking behind The Night Watchman, is a good place to start is this quote from managing editor Matt Thacker. I'd been frustrated for some time by the constraints of the mainstream media and had come to realise I wasn't the only one who felt journalism as a whole was missing something, that there should be more space for more in-depth pieces, for detailed reportage, history and analysis. Could we do something that was neither magazine nor book, but somewhere in between? Have they pulled it off? Have they succeeded in their quite lofty aim?
It's been a real pleasure reading The Night Watchman over the last couple of weeks. When we arrive for a podcast, we're usually fairly, I mean, it may not sound as if we're in any way efficient, but we're usually fairly efficient, and we sort of start at the beginning with what we're going to discuss. But we arrived today, and we were both talking about the articles that we have read and the different things that have caught our eye. And actually, one of the first things that really caught my eye was the real breadth of content within it. One of the things that I've got slightly annoyed with the Wisden Cricketer about recently is that both they've cut down on the breadth of their articles, but they're all sort of written from the same, I love Michael Atherton, but from the same sort of Michael Atherton perspective. And one of the things that's wonderful about this is the breadth of different voices that are allowed, you know, several thousand words each to have their say.
And I think the key point here is that the freedom given to writers. So we have these articles, I guess almost calling them essays is fairer, actually. Mm. You have these essays where writers are able to talk about the relationship between cricket and their own lives. Writers are able to talk about sort of strange stories within cricket that have been forgotten. Writers are allowed to talk about connections between cricket and totally different passions. And I think maybe that's where The Night Watchman really triumphs, by giving great writers the opportunity to have that free rein that maybe conventional magazines don't give them.
So two things that have caught, two articles that I think demonstrate that quite nicely from the beginning and the end of the edition. At the very beginning, John Hosson talking about the mind of the Night Watchman, And he is the mind behind the old batsman who
we've had him on the show.
Talked to him in the past. We've had the privilege of having him on the show, and it's a beautifully well written piece, really thoroughly researched, really engaging piece, which is sort of part history, part psychology, a sort of a true cricket article. And then towards the end, a very interesting piece by Jarrod Kimber on Michael Clarke, which in some senses, and I don't mean this in a sort of deprecating way, in some senses, the kind of the hello journalism style of cricket writing, where he's talking about Michael Clarke's celebrity side, and he sort of gets his hands dirty in that respect. And the fact that a magazine, I mean, was that
Michael Clarke or Jarrod Kimber getting his hands dirty? Let's
not clarify that, I think.
Okay.
But I think the sort of bold of the magazine, it's something they talk about at the beginning, not to have an editor who says we are going to have one style, that they're able to contain all these different styles within it, and makes it,
and I think the point you make, I mean, they're a great pair to choose, because I think they're both outstanding articles but with completely different styles and completely different approaches. I mean, I think I very much enjoyed the freedom given to writers to explore those parts of the game that we've always had an inkling about but never really seen understood. Osman Samuddin's article on discovering why it sometimes just clicks for Pakistan is a fascinating piece about the propensity of the Pakistani cricket team throughout, you know, over years and years, to find unbelievable periods of brilliance at sort of the oddest moments. And it's an incredibly compelling article because, like several of these essays, it connects cricket to much broader ideas. So it connects cricket with this idea of people who only really deliver when they're under pressure, when they're in a sort of difficult situation. And I think ultimately, when we look at cricket journalism and what it should be, cricket journalism should speak to cricket, but it should also speak to much wider ideas, you know, of politics, of art, of all these sort of greater things. I guess... Sorry, do you want to...
Yeah, well, no, I was just going to say two quick things on the sort of... On the format of it and the way that it sort of allows this cricket journalism to speak. It's very pared down. You said it's more like essays than articles, and I think that's completely right. That it is, it's just pages upon pages of text and occasional sort of full page photos, but there aren't sort of pull quotes all over the type, all over the place trying to sex it up. It's very much saying that this journalism speaks for itself. One of the, quite interestingly, we both bought it online and are sitting here with printed out copies, which I think is fairly indicative. Although, I mean, I would certainly be very inclined to subscribe to the paper edition. But one of the things again that it talks about in the introduction is the fact that in the 21st century, a lot of journalism is very immediate, and Twitter is the kind of epitome of that. But this is very much about leisure time reading. It's the kind of thing that you sort of, I mean, I spend quite a lot of time in the bath, and it's the kind of thing that I've been
just getting personal confessional.
Well, you know, this is the kind of thing that evokes personal confessional, but it's the kind of thing that you do just sort of lie back and really, you know, pour yourself a glass of whiskey and
but
enjoy.
But I think this is the point that not all, and this is a point we've, an idea that we've come to before on the podcast, that not all sports lend themselves as naturally to kind of deep analysis and deep thought. And it is one of the joys of cricket that it does, and that it allows all sorts of different, and this magazine has certainly allowed that opportunity to be undertaken. I think what's interesting, in the introduction, they make very clear that the Night Watchman's aim is to allow voices from all spheres. So it's like they're not just looking for professional cricket journalists. And one of the successes of that, I think, is that you're able to get connections between cricket and very different endeavours. So Patrick Neat, a novelist, reflects on the game as a revealer of character. And there's a brilliant part in his article where he considers the difference between what David Gower's life would look like if it was a film and David Gower's life would look like as a novel. And he kind of concludes, well, actually, cricket's the game of the novel. It's a, characters are slowly revealed over many pages and developed. It's not a kind of slap-bang Hollywood movie. And to allow a novelist the freedom to make that connection is, I think, central to what this magazine is about.
To the interview and this episode, I spoke to Nishant Joshi, editor of the excellent and irreverent Alternative Cricket Almanac.
As a podcast, we're not particularly great on the IPL. We've sort of got into it bit by bit, and I think we've both suffered from that kind of English... English kind of fear of, you know, what is this new thing? And as a sort of a self-confessed IPL addict, I wonder if you could kind of let me in, you know, what is for you the real compelling reason for watching the IPL? What really gets you into it?
Well, I think that what really got me into it in the first season of the IPL was the prospect of having almost your sort of own fantasy team. It seemed like just having all of your favourite players of all time, in some cases, playing together in the same team, on the same pitch against each other in a really short period of time. With that added sort of intensity, I think, that the IPL brings, I think that was the initial draw for me. And even a few years on, now we're in the sixth season of the IPL, of course. The other day for Royal Challengers Bangalore, we had Chris Gayle batting with Virat Kohli and AB de Villiers, which is it's just insane. It's mind-blowing. And Murali on the same team as well. There's nowhere else on Earth where you can actually experience that sort of thing, except for maybe the odd team on the Big Bash.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose you are used to seeing these players competing against each other internationally. But I guess what you're saying is the particular attraction is, I mean, there's been a lot of talk in this IPL about that extraordinary Tendulkar Ponting. You've got, what have you named it on your blog?
Pondulka,
exactly, yeah. So you've got that, and there was so much attention to that. So do you think there's something more special about actually seeing them as teammates, perhaps, and seeing them as and rather than just seeing them in their usual international setup, as it were?
Yeah, of course. I mean, right now, of course, we mentioned Pondulka. I mean, in that whole Mumbai Indian setup, you've got this whole backstory, this whole narrative, which you couldn't have even dreamed up maybe 5 years ago. Of course, after there was that Monkeygate fracas in Australia during India's tour, and now you have Harbhajan Singh, Sachin Tendulkar on the same team. Okay, along with Ricky Ponting captaining them. And then you also have in the backroom staff someone like Anil Kumble as well. So all of the protagonists of that sort of the whole debacle which went down, and you have them all on the same team. You couldn't have even imagined it in your wildest dream 5 years ago. And now they're hugging each other.
So exactly, it must create some fascinating dynamics behind the scenes. I guess one thing that's interesting, because as a tournament, it's still relatively in its infancy. And I guess one thing I'm really curious about is, do you think it's got to the stage where the teams have a real identity? You're someone who knows it well. You've watched all of it, really, haven't you? And do you get a sense of the teams, because I guess just to give the example of something like the Premier League in football, or even actually, say, county cricket, for example, in the UK, the teams have been around for long enough where supporters have a sense of like each team having their identity. You kind of know what that team's about. Has the IPL got to that stage yet, or are they still quite, do the teams still feel quite mixed up in terms of players?
I feel that it's getting there, although in some teams you have some... I mean, the auctions tend to be so regular, and the contracts tend to be only 2 or 3 years. So, of course, next year we're going to have a complete overhaul of teams, and right now it looks like teams will only be able to retain 4 players for each side, and the rest will go into a draft pick or an auction, as it were. And you do tend to wonder about whether fans will really kind of keep that attachment that they will have to teams, or whether they'll just follow players around the country. And I do think that overall there is a sort of blend. I mean, the best example perhaps is that of Gautam Gambhir. I mean, he started off, of course, in IPL 1, opening the innings for Delhi with Virender Sehwag. And they're, of course, the two Delhi home stars. And then in the next auction, they actually sold him off to Calcutta Knight Riders. So there was a bit of perhaps different disenfranchisement with fans in that sort of situation. There was that sort of disillusionment where fans couldn't really grasp, well, we're supposed to be supporting our home team, and yet we've just sold our number one home man to one of our rivals. So there is that sort of disillusionment, which I think is going to crop up every time it comes around to auction.
That however, is interesting, because it strikes me that having these home players is a fantastic way to create identity.
Yeah.
Because I know, going back to that comparison, I think one problem the Premier League in football has is that issue that it's becoming harder and harder to tie Everton to Liverpool, for example. You know, they've got fewer and fewer players with local roots. So it seems like a brilliant idea if you can keep, I think you said local stars, that sort of idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder whether you made the interesting point about people following players. Just giving the example, someone like Chris Gayle, could you imagine him moving on and taking a lot of fans with him? Is that the kind of thing you were thinking of, or?
Oh, for sure. I mean, he's the global T20 superstar at the moment. And it does seem that any side he goes to, whether it be in the Big Bash, where he didn't have so much success this year, but fans still came out in their droves to see him. I believe he's on Somerset's radar for
yes,
this
yeah.
year in the Friends Live T20 in the UK. And I'm sure there's going to be a full house at Somerset every time he plays in a T20 match. I mean, I might even drive down from London just to catch a glimpse of Gale in this sort of stick cricket form that he's in right now.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it? Because you sometimes think, well, imagine that, you know, you go down to Somerset for the evening and that's the one day where Gale goes for a sort of 15-ball 3, and you think, God,
yeah.
That's the only issue when you go sort of watch individual players. Now, whoever comes on the show, we always like to ask at one point in the interview, just put them on the spot and say, put them in the kind of cricket administrator seat. And I was thinking,
yeah.
in your case in particular, it'd be fascinating to know if you were in a position of power in the IPL, what changes would you make? What innovations would you make?
Well, I think that overall the IPL is developing reasonably well in terms of actually bringing around local players. I mean, I think IPL 6 is a lot more competitive than previous years. Usually you see teams who've maybe been carrying 3 or 4 passengers, usually the local players, the younger players, who seem to be bowling expensive last overs and in some cases dropping expensive catches and throwing the games away for their sides, for the weaker teams especially. But now that we've got to IPL 6, it seems that India have developed a very strong core player of a very strong core of younger players who are really well suited to T20, the type who bowl the slow balls out of the back of the hand regularly. And may not go on to ODI or test success, but who are reaching a strong IPL level. So I do think that in terms of player development, that's been pretty good. I mean, if I were to be an administrator, I mean, this is quite an interesting point in the case of the IPL, because even if I were an administrator, then it feels like the power is kind of centralized around Chennai Super Kings and Mumbai Indians in the IPL, where effectively there's a sort of dichotomy where you have one rule for the richest and another set of rules for the rest. I mean, the current situation with Sri Lankan players being banned in Chennai rather conveniently for the Chennai Super Kings is bordering on farce, disguised as a political situation, which, I mean, the team have used to their own advantage. And I think that's the main sort of issue of the IPL right now. You have the haves and the have-nots, the richer poor teams and the poor teams. So I think the main thing that I would try to improve is kind of maintaining that there's a level playing field.
Because it's interesting, because I remember IPL 1 when Rajasthan won, and that was always seen as quite, because they were seen as one of the poorer teams, weren't they? They were seen as one of the kind of lesser. And I always thought that was a great start for the tournament, the fact that you showed that the underdog could win. But I suppose after a few years, if the spending keeps going with the major teams, I wondered one thing in terms of the progress of the tournament, because you talked about how the young players have progressed, how India have developed this effective core of young T20 players. One mistake I think a lot of English fans in particular make when looking at 2020 is they often see it as a very simple game. They see it as a slogging game. And one thing I've realised more and more watching it is that it's incredibly skillful. It's incredibly tactical. And I wondered if you feel that over the 6 seasons, teams have got savvier, like you've seen teams get cleverer. And if so, I mean, have you got maybe any examples of how they've developed in that way, how they've tactically maybe grown?
Well, and I think that, I mean, T20 has been around for what, like 10, 11 years after it first started in England. And I do think that after this sort of period of time, I think it was kind of acceptable to maybe disregard T20 when it was in its infancy, in its first couple of years. It's just a bit of fun, just a bit of a slog. And then as teams have developed, a few sides, I think perhaps more, a few shrewder players have become more accustomed to T20 and adjusted their game really well. But on the whole, I think that team tactics have been exceptionally poor. I think that even the most basic sort of tactics that you'd have expected to have developed over the IPL's 300 games so far, it really hasn't come along as much as I was hoping, especially if you compare to the likes of for example, NFL in the US or Premier League football in the UK as well. I think that the IPL and T20 as a whole is languishing really far behind. I mean, in terms of individual innovations, I'd say things like fielding have come along an incredible way. That is, fielding today is almost unrecognizable from what it was 10 years ago. Whereas 10 years ago, you maybe have maybe four or five exceptionally good fielders on in a team, perhaps South Africa and Australia, and you'd have a couple of passengers. Now you're looking at having seven or eight really, really strong fielders who could field in any position, and maybe you have one or two weaker bowlers. I mean, if you look at some of the spectacular catches, the types where they're caught on the behind the boundary and then they're lobbed up to a partner and that sort of thing, I think that's where the real innovation has happened.
It's interesting because I think that skill set... I entirely agree with you, has improved ridiculously just because teams almost won't tolerate it. They can't tolerate poor fielding. But it's interesting to hear you say that actually you feel, in terms of strategy, in terms of being clever about T20, you still think there's a long way to go.
Yeah, I mean, for example, I recently wrote a piece on strategy just in the IPL, and it's more to do with just really simple things, which I thought that over six seasons, and I mean, none of the players can really say that they're inexperienced with T20, because even in their younger years now, if you have, for example, a young player like Quinton de Kock, now he's playing for Sunrisers Hyderabad, a very talented young wicketkeeper from South Africa, and he's had a lot of experience just in T20. He's only 20 years old, but he's played under 19 level, domestic level. He's played even in the Champions League T20. So even as such a young player, you're getting that sort of experience at T20 level, which hasn't really translated into T20 now for a lot of players.
Well, are you talking about the article where you looked at how to win the IPL? Is that the
yeah.
one? Yeah, I mean, I found that extremely interesting as someone who's still kind of getting into it. And I thought one thing that was really interesting, you made this point about, yeah, you called it the wickets in hand fallacy.
Yeah.
And I thought that really struck a chord with me because it's become one of those things that commentators will sort of say.
Yeah.
As if it's an absolute given. You're like, oh, they've got wickets in hand, they're fine. And then you realise, and you make the point in business that it's so often, just not true. And I guess... because what was interesting about your article is you made several points that it was very, very thorough, but you made several points that you feel should be obvious. Don't you? You make points like, you know, don't attack the best bowlers, ensure your best bowlers. So why do you, is there a reason why teams are getting it wrong? I mean, is it just a question of maybe coaching? Do you think we are going to see a jump in this, or do you have any idea as to why there hasn't been this kind of adaptation of strategy?
Well, I mean, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it, Andy? I mean, it is kind of dumbfounding. When I was analysing some of the tactics and putting together that piece, I just couldn't fathom how you could spend $1 million on a player like Glenn Maxwell and then not even play him. I mean, I think Mumbai is six or seven games into their season. He hasn't even got a look in.
Yeah.
And they've spent $1 million on him. But how can you... It's like letting a Ferrari sit in the garage gathering dust. And it's just just mind-boggling.
What I find extraordinary about that is, again, I don't know what goes on behind the scenes, but you assume there was a lot of thinking how well they spend their money, and yet they've done it, and it's absolutely fascinating stuff. It's great to talk about the IPL. I genuinely find it very, very informative. Just to move on to the world of blogging, we've sort of mentioned that cricket blogging is extremely, it's a very kind of full field now. There's lots and lots of different blogs doing lots of different things. And I wondered, when you sort of setting up Alternative Cricket, where did you kind of see your niche in that? Where did you see your role?
Well, really, just as his name says it, Andy, I mean, we really did just set it up to be an alternative. I mean, to be honest, when I set up Alternative Cricket, it was just meant to be a brief sort of support for the book that we launched in 2011. It was called the Alternative Cricket
Almanac. Yeah, sure.
And I envisaged it as maybe I write a few articles from time to time for a few months, and then I go back to not writing so much and just kind of do it as a one-off experience. But it gathered momentum really quickly, and 2.5 odd 8 years later, here I am still writing. Yeah.
So do you think, I get two sort of slightly different questions, but Firstly, do you enjoy the kind of do you enjoy the pressure of having to produce for a blog? Because I think when sometimes we speak to bloggers who say it's both very fun but also quite challenging, because for blogs to stay relevant, they do need, you know, fairly regular updates. So, I mean, do you enjoy that pressure of kind of needing to produce stuff?
Well, I've never actually felt a need to produce. Perhaps even the opposite. I feel that the blog market right now, especially cricket blog market, it seems that every man and his dog has a blog about something going on in cricket. Mm. So it does seem that it is quite oversaturated. And I don't feel that we have a need to produce. Maybe it's just because I am a medical student right now, and I don't actually have the time to write as many articles as I would like to. Perhaps right now we're putting about an average of around one article per week, which I'm quite happy with, because I think it's important to maintain that sort of level of quality. I mean, if I get a contribution from one of our regular writers, then I do go through it with them, make sure it's edited to the highest standard that we can actually make it. So I try to avoid putting things on our blog which I don't feel that are of the highest standard. So it's more of a quality over quantity thing.
I mean, that I find really interesting and frankly quite reassuring, because one thing I definitely find with some blogs is there does seem to be, quality control is an issue, because I think there's almost a temptation to publish everything and keep it. But I think it's very important, as you said, to say no and to actually make decisions over what the best piece would look like. I guess this leads me into the next point about it is a very saturated sort of sphere, like the cricket blogosphere. And yeah. I wondered, in your opinion, is there a lot of good quality stuff being produced? I mean, do you feel it's, I guess the big question is cricket writing in good shape?
I think cricket writing on the whole is in good shape, but what I'm finding is that there are several really good writers that I like to follow, and I keep an eye on their articles especially. But it's the sort of people who are perhaps trying too hard to churn out something every single day, and I think that's kind of devaluing it for all cricket bloggers. It makes people less likely to click on really good articles, and that's where I feel that perhaps the better writers are perhaps being drowned out at times. And in this regard, I feel that perhaps cricket writing and cricket blogging is perhaps mimicking what's happening with actual news websites right now, in that you have the sort of Daily Mail and Huffington Post sort of chop shop websites where they take any sort of content and they put a picture of an alluring lady and they say, "Ooh, look at this. Miley Cyrus's side boob," or whatever, and they get lots of hits for it. And I think there are some I'm not really sure how to put it, but perhaps Daily Mail mimicking sort of cricket websites, which are trying hard to kind of replicate that sort of just tabloid headline grabbing sort of thing, so that you click on their article and that they get their revenue from whatever source. And that's kind of devaluing it for all cricket bloggers. There is good cricket writing. It's just really hard to find it.
Yeah. Well, I think I often feel that given cricket has such a definitive website in Crick Info, bloggers have to really establish, you know, what can I add, what am I? And I very clearly in my head, it falls into those bloggers that do and those bloggers that don't. I was curious to say, you said you've got a couple of writers who you have as real go-to people. I wondered if you could mention just a few of who you see as the kind of the people you will look to for good writing.
Yeah, I mean, the guys writing for our website, I mean, we have a lot of submissions every week, maybe around 15 to 20, of which I reject quite a lot of, put on the back burner and ask them to rewrite quite a lot of it, a fair bit of the time. I mean, two writers who stand out on our website, James Marsh and Josh Taylor, very, very underappreciated writers and very good satirical eye, which fits in really well with our website. Going away from us, I think Wisden India, there's one lady called Anjali Doshi who's been quite exceptional in her recent pieces. What I find is quite a lot of writers, especially when talking about India, especially when talking about the IPL, Tendulkar, that sort of thing, especially there are so many articles about whether or not Sachin Tendulkar should retire, and it just breeds such a sense of ennui. It just feels like I've read every single article a million times over, and I just get bored of reading things, even though I'm such a big fan of cricket, such a big fan of reading interesting things. I'm just kind of fed up of it. And what Anjali does is she really gives an honest opinion, and it's all really ultra logical and really unbiased as well. So I really appreciate that from her. And the other writer who really stands out for me is the old batsman. He's better known as John Hotten.
Yes, we've had him on the show. I mean, he really is. He is special. Well, because he's interesting, because he basically treats his blog as they're cricket essays, aren't they? They're not really blog posts.
Yeah.
But no, you've certainly drawn attention. There are definitely some authors there who are, I'm sure our listeners won't know, and it's great. I think I really agree with you that it's so important that good writers aren't drowned out.
To the debate. And as Ricky Ponting and Adam Gilchrist drop themselves as captains of their respective IPL sides, we ask whether making yourself unavailable can ever be a sign of true leadership.
I think a lot of this comes down to why do you pick a certain player as a captain? And in both Ricky Ponting and Adam Gilchrist's case, they've been picked because they're true cricketing legends. You know, they were part of an Aussie golden generation that won everything lots of times over.
And therefore, they're playing for these IPL sides brings in a lot of money in gate receipts.
So that is part of the story. Let's be honest about that. Part of the big story. I rather love this phrase that Nishan Joshi gave us, actually, of Pondulka. This a partnership of Ponting and Tendulkar that has created more, you know, fuss around
it's
the
a kind of Godzilla type.
It's a ferocious world, thing. But Ponting and Gilchrist both made the decision that they were not performing to the level they should be. In a way, not surprising, just to take a very minor detour, because these are players who weren't kind of raised with 2020. They've had to learn it. But anyway, they made the decision that other players who are outside the starting lineup should be playing instead, should be scoring those runs. But I think the issue here is that what those players both have is unbelievable charisma. You are a young Indian seamer playing in your first IPL. You have Ricky Ponting as your captain, right? That is a meaningful, powerful thing to have behind you. It's a charisma to have behind you. And that's why I'm slightly uncomfortable with perhaps the speed and the willingness. I think I respect both of them. I respect both of them for their recognition of their limitations. But I also feel like they need to understand that what they were brought to do was bigger than simply deliver runs.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. This debate could sort of sprawl and sprawl. We've recently sadly learnt of the death of Mike Dennis, who famously dropped himself as a captain of England.
But during an Ashes series, actually.
Playing for England during an Ashes series. But I think that fundamentally, the question is... Well, there are two questions. One, how important is a captain within a 2020 side?
Mm.
And two, how important is, what are the broader issues within 2020? What are we trying to... I mean, I made the statement about gate receipts slightly flippantly, but I think it's actually quite important because the IPL is something that is based pretty fundamentally on money. And actually, if you were to get a kind of team of all-stars back, if they were to persuade, you know, Shane Warne to come back and captain, then that would have incredible gate receipts. But one thing that it would do would be to undermine slightly the integrity of it as a cricketing exploit. And I think one of the things that's been very sad about the demise of Ricky Ponting in cricket, and actually Tendulkar is in danger of doing as well, is the fact that he doesn't know when to let go, as it were. And actually, so this issue of sort of keeping people on simply because they're a name, and particularly in the captaincy vein, is I think a questionable one. But then on the other issue of how important the captain is within 2020, I think that actually 2020 is so much a game of individuals, and it's very, very rare. Occasionally you do see tactical masterpieces that turn a game, but ultimately I think with 2020 most of the work is done tactically before the game starts.
Well, I think there is more opportunity for strategy in 2020 than has been fully exploited. Actually, I think you can make an argument whether Ricky Ponting or Adam Gilchrist are the right people to do that, but I think coming back to this central...
exactly as you say, Ponting did not grow up with this game, as you said. The reason that he's not succeeding at it, the reason he's not scoring runs, is because it's not native to him.
But
therefore, should he be captaining
I entirely take your point that there is this tragic thing, not just within cricket, but I think actually most famously within boxing. I've always thought this idea that, you know, people can't let go, They always believe they can go that one fight, that one game further. And both Ricky Ponting and Adam Gilchrist, I think, deserve a lot of respect for their entirely honest recognition that their performance just hasn't been good enough. That being said, I think they both are understating their charisma and the role that charisma can play as a captain. Ricky Ponting, as your captain, is a formidable thing. This is a guy who has won an unbelievable number of test matches, World Cup.
For you to look up to him
as a young player, to see him on the pitch is a big deal.
But his simple... I don't know if his simple presence there suddenly does. I mean, if he came and played with my club side, just because Ricky Ponting's standing at mid-off, it's not really going to make us play any better.
But what
is going to make teams play better is having someone who's on top of their game playing. Now, the simple fact that he's played 100-odd tests actually means absolutely nothing in the context of being out there in the game. And I completely take your point about... particularly somewhere like the IPL, and actually, as far as I'm concerned, the only good thing about the IPL is that it is the fact that it gives a lot of exposure and a lot of integration between young Indian players and cricketers, the best cricketers from all over the world. And I think that's a wonderful thing, potentially,
for
Indian cricket in particular. But I think simply that the presence of players there for their own sake, what is a good influence is them there playing well rather than them there sitting in a wheelchair.
I mean, I guess the bigger issue here is really whether we see these players as having like a long-term future in the game as well, or whether this is really something that we're seeing as their farewell. Because I think that in a lot of these cases, it can be interpreted as kind of Ricky Ponting's farewell.
Or them getting their pension.
Well, quite, and they're picking up a paycheck. I think a lot of this also comes down to this idea of, do we believe that teams can carry a captain? You know, are there some captains that actually... we're willing to accept the fact that they're not there on merit, right? That there are other batsmen who can make more runs. And I think, historically, cricket's been more comfortable with that idea. I mean, Mike Brearley's often been quoted as an example of that. Is the obvious example. And I think it's an idea we've become less and less comfortable with.
But neither Adam Gilchrist nor Ricky Ponting are tactical geniuses. And if they're not firing, and if they're not firing with the bat... they're not tactical geniuses as a captain, and they're not putting in the kind of performances that are going to inspire the people around them, then I think it is difficult to see why they should be there.
I think what will be fascinating is whether this is the start of a trend as well. Are we going to see lots and lots more of this where, you know, the big snazzy name gets made captain and then slowly, quietly, surreptitiously drops themselves?
Thank you for listening to the 45th episode of Reverse Prep Radio. Here's the deal for the next episode. We want to know what you think are the burning issues in cricket at the moment, and that's what we're going to debate at the end of the episode, and that's what you're going to hear us tearing at each other's throats about. You can reach us on Twitter at Reverse Swept, or if you're not still a Luddite and you're not on Twitter, you can email us at reversewepradio@gmail.com. Do send us your thoughts, and we look forward to discussing.